Congratulations! You have found the Lambcast, the official podcast of the Large Association of Movie Blogs, also known as the Lamb. The Lamb is the largest collective of online movie blogs and podcasts with 2,000 members and counting. Every week on the Lambcast, various members of the Lamb community get together to talk about our favorite subject, movies. So bookmark the Lamb and follow us on social media. Be sure to join us each week to hear a lively discussion of films and movie-related talk from our members. Join the flock at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Get in, losers. This is Lambcast episode 718, featuring a bunch of mean girls and a couple of old guys. Hi, everyone. I'm your host, Richard Kirkham, and this week on the Lambcast, we're taking a musical excursion to North Shore High School. Oh, and we're also going to take a side trip to Ass-Kicking Town. The original film Mean Girls from 2004, on its opening weekend, grossed $24 million. The film closed in September, grossing $86 million domestically and $43 million internationally for a worldwide total of $129 million. In 2004, Paramount said the audience was 75% female and 50% was under the age of 18. And over 90% of the moviegoers rated the movie either excellent or very good. And it got strong notices even outside of the target demographic. The musical play, made from the film, premiered on Halloween in 2017, and it opened on Broadway in March of 2018. It ran for 833 performances before becoming a victim of COVID in March of 2020. The film version of the musical was already in development when the show closed, and it was originally scheduled to be released as a streaming film on the Paramount Plus network. But after positive scoring and previews, it was decided to do a theatrical release. And here it is in the second week of January, a traditional dumping ground for films. But Mean Girls is pulling in 73% female audience. On a three-day basis, the picture's looking to make $27 million. So who do we have on the show to talk about the movie? Two men, well over 30, and no queen bee to tell us what to say. So after we talk about the girls' film, we'll get to some testosterone to reestablish our XY credentials with a conversation about Jason Statham and The Beekeeper. By the way, guys showed up for The Beekeeper at 62% of the audience, with 42% of the ticket holders being between 18 and 34, and those over 45, that's Todd and me, being 38% of the audience. Todd Liebenau from Forgotten Films joins me for today's show. Welcome in, Todd.
Thank you. I think this show is going to be pretty fetch.
That's kind of the way I see it, you know. And you know what? We're going to make fetch happen.
We are indeed.
So we'll start with Mean Girls. Give me your history about Mean Girls and what you thought of the original film before we get to today's film.
So, well, I definitely didn't see the original film in the theater. I wasn't seeing a lot of things in the theater back 20 years ago when it came out. That was the early days of me being a parent. I had a, what, when did that come? It came out in
2004.
Exactly 20 years ago.
Yeah.
So I would have had a one-year-old and a four-year-old at the time. So yeah, I wasn't getting out much. I eventually did see it on video and I enjoyed it a lot. You know, I like Tina Fey's style of comedy. I really have enjoyed 30 Rock and The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, I think, are both really funny shows. So I do like her comedic sensibilities. And, you know, I definitely wasn't the target demographic for Mean Girls, but I eventually saw it and enjoyed it quite a bit. I can't say I've revisited it a whole lot. I've seen it here and there. I mean, I'm not the demographic. This is not a film that would have been the cultural touchstone for me like it is for, you know, people that were teenagers 20 years ago. So, you know, I enjoyed it, but it's not a film that I have, you know, a special place in my heart for. And I meant to actually kind of revisit it before going to see the musical version, but I did not pull that off. So I was, you know, going by my vague memories of the other times that I've seen the original film.
Yeah, I'm in a similar boat with you. I did see it when it opened originally, and my kids were the target audience. That was 2004, so I think my daughters were 12 and 16, no, four, I don't know. I'm having to do math in my head. They were 16 and 14, I think it was, when it came out, something like that. And it was, you know, they were high schoolers at that point, and so I went with them, and they enjoyed it, and I think it's been a touchstone for their generation over the years. My daughter went to a birthday party for one of her coworkers a few weeks ago, and it was basically a Mean Girls themed party.
Oh, cool.
So they had, you know, music playing and that kind of stuff.
I get the impression that for the folks that were in high school 20 years ago, that this is, you know, a lot like a movie like Ferris Bueller's Day Off or The Breakfast Club is going to be for me, who was a teenager in the 80s.
Right. Or American Graffiti for me.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's every generation has their kind of touchstone films, the ones that they relate to. And I think especially for women, Mean Girls held a special place for that generation. I'm like you. I think I've seen the film twice. I saw it when it played in theaters, and mm-hmm. I saw it when we bought it on video, probably in 2005. I think I saw it again because in those days I always made sure to watch a movie when I bought it. Now I frequently have movies that I bought and I say I'm going to watch that someday. But I did go back and check this week and watch it, the original again. And I can safely say that the new film and the original have very minor differences between them, except mm-hmm. for the music. The story is exactly the same, and a lot of the dialogue is exactly the same. They changed just a few things for the social media things and maybe to streamline the movie a little bit.
And I do think that was one of the things that the film did pretty well when it comes to the updating it for, you know, the 2024 audience, you know, kind of incorporating the things that are more a part of high school culture when it comes to everybody's got a phone and you know, TikTok and social media and all that kind of stuff, how, you know, certain types of events that you know, would have played out a little bit differently back 20 years ago. You know, nowadays, you know, everybody's going to whip out their phone and film a fight in the school hallway or whatever.
Exactly. Exactly. So, yeah, I think they updated that pretty well. I did do a comparison between the musical on Broadway and the film, and they took out a lot of songs.
I read that, too. I mean, I'm not familiar with the Broadway musical at all. I hadn't realized that it opened that recently, that it's just basically just a little before COVID. I would have thought this had been out there a little bit longer than that. But, I mean, what do I know? I don't follow Broadway much. But I was looking up probably the same articles you were and saw there's like, what, like a dozen or more songs that
exactly.
were left out of this version. Yeah.
And they changed a couple of the songs that they had. They switched out apparently the introductory song for Katie, and they adjusted the song that Regina does a little bit. And I guess they wrote a couple of new songs, but like I said, it's apparently the Broadway show ran 2.5 hours and the movie's 90 minutes. So that'll give you a sense of how much trimming they did to make it fit to a theatrical presentation for a movie.
And it's kind of funny that they would do that in some ways. I mean, I, as you said, it was originally going to be a streaming movie. And maybe that's part of it, but I mean, other movies certainly don't shy away from 2.5 hour runtimes these days. And I mean, even like some of the other musicals that have been out, I mean, The Color Purple ran 2.5 hours. And so, yeah, who knows why they do these things?
I'm not in charge. Yeah. Somebody else has to make those decisions. We've talked a little bit about the previous film. I thought it was very creative. Let's talk about this particular film. What are its strengths? What are its weaknesses? What's something that stands out to you? Let's start with the strengths of the film. Is there something in this movie that you think justifies its existence. Because I've seen some people online complaining, saying, what are we doing this for? Is this just a cash grab?
Yeah, well, and I got to admit, I always struggle a little bit when people say that, because, and granted, I'm probably guilty of having said, why do we need this film, or this film isn't necessary, with various other projects over the years. We all get into that mode sometimes, but ultimately, is any film necessary? You know, I mean,
yeah.
They make movies to make money, and that's the way it goes. But, I mean, with this, I've always kind of looked at, especially when you have a film or a book or who knows what it is, and then it's changed into something else, like a Broadway musical. Yeah, sure, give me another version of that on the big screen. I'm fine with that. And I do think that probably one of the things that stuck with me on this film was I thought the songs were very strong, and the musical numbers in general. Having come off of a couple of different musicals here this season, I actually think this one pulls off the musical moments the best. I enjoyed Wonka quite a bit. I think you were a bit more excited about it than I was, but I still thought it was a very good film. And The Color Purple I enjoyed as well. But I think this one has the most interesting musical sequences out of the three musicals that I've seen here in the last month. I don't know. I just think there's a fun creativity to it, a lot of unique visuals. I think they do a good, solid job of making it cinematic. I think one of the issues I had with The Color Purple, which again, I enjoyed that film, but I thought the musical numbers were very stagey. It felt more like I was in the audience watching it on Broadway on a stage than watching something that was a movie. And I've always said, if you're going to take something from Broadway and turn it into a movie, I want there to be, you know, something more cinematic about it. And I think that this film does a better job of making those musical sequences more cinematic.
It's funny, because the main criticism I had of the film's musical elements was that it didn't feel like it was particularly stagey. I think the musical numbers needed to pop a little bit more. They felt to me to be very contained, like people just walking through a background where other people are singing also, without necessarily having much choreography or something distinctive that's going on in the production design, which maybe makes the film feel a little bit more like it's a natural extension of the original movie. But to me, that I already had the original movie. I'd already seen the original movie. So what I wanted was something a little bit more different, something that was like a Broadway showstopper. And I did not pick out any song in the movie that I thought was the kind of showstopper that you say, that's the number that everybody's going to remember. That's the thing that people are going to enjoy. When I talked about the movie afterwards with my daughter, I said, well, what were your favorite musical moments? She picked two completely different things than the thing that I liked.
Oh, okay.
You know, so I think they're all...
Which ones were the ones that stood out for you then? If you were picking the favorites, which ones was it for you?
The one that stood out for me was the Regina number that comes toward the end, and I'm trying to remember the title of it, dang it. I should have checked.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, I'm looking at a song.
Watching the World Burn.
Right, right. Yeah,
That was the one that I liked.
I enjoyed that one. I liked the, I think it's called Revenge Party number, where it does kind of go into this kind of fantasy setting where the hallway kind of takes on a different color scheme and the costumes are unique. It actually reminded me a little bit of the shift that happens in the original animated Lion King for the song I Just Can't Wait to Be King, where like the music starts and the look and the colors and the animation style of the animals all kind of shifts in that moment, and then when the song is done, it goes back to what the rest of the film looks like. And I kind of got that same impression from the Revenge Party sequence. I think that's the one that jumped out to me the most.
And I'm trying to remember. I think that Amanda liked sexy, which I thought she enjoyed that one. And there was something else that she appreciated. I'm trying to remember. It's the one that maybe what's the character Gretchen sings? What's Wrong with Me?
Oh yeah, no, that was a good moment as well. I agree. The sexy song, I thought that one was fun. I think part of it, what I like about that song is just the humor in it. I love just the commentary of the idea that pretty much young women, the Halloween costumes that are often promoted to them and that they go for at times are just sexy this, sexy that, now, sexy nurse, sexy whatever. So I thought that was very, very clever. The Apex Predator song also jumped out at me, where it's, the various students start kind of taking on the motions of different animals and such, and the choreography is all very much like they're animals out in the jungle or whatever. I thought that was an interesting sequence.
That was the one sequence that took advantage of this notion that Katie grew up in Africa and that her family had a background in studying, cultures and animals in another world, and there was a little bit of a connection there. I thought that was mostly absent from this film, whereas in the original film there was a little bit more of that. There was a lot more parallel between the idea of the queen bees and the apex predators and the way the animals approach each other, and there was a little bit more humor based on Katie being an outsider to the world, because she had been with her family on the other side of the world in a fairly primitive part of the world, doing things very differently than the kids that she was going to be interacting with. Here it just seemed like she was a transfer student.
Yeah, well, and also I guess, I mean, if that brings me to maybe one of the things I thought was a little weaker on this, is I did feel that the Katie character was a bit underdeveloped. And, maybe that has to do with what we were talking about, with a lot being trimmed out of this for the movie version. But it just kind of felt like, especially with the transition of her from being this timid person who hasn't had any life in an American school system and all that kind of stuff, to then becoming, the leader of the plastics for a bit there, it seemed very abrupt. And, it was like, I just didn't feel like I got enough of a development of her early on and then enough of a transition for her.
Yes. And I think in addition to that Regina's character gets a little bit more attention, and she's actually the main character in the film, and Katie is almost the secondary character. At least they are equivalent characters if you were judging it based on the amount of time that's devoted to each of them and the number of songs that they get to do, I guess. Maybe that would be another way to measure those things. Anything else in terms of strengths of the film? Did you think any of the performers stood out for you, or was there something about the way that you mentioned the way the contemporary social media gets integrated into the film? I liked the sequence where Karen, who is using her cell phone to record things at the party. We kind of get those TikTok video sorts of things interjected in the film. I thought that was pretty clever and a good, like you said, a good way to make it more cinematic and update it for these times. I thought that was another strength of the film. Was there anything else that you noticed that made this maybe a little bit more distinct or something memorable?
Well, and I will kind of just dovetail off that. There's a musical number where they actually kind of utilize the TikTok and all that, where you have multiple screens up there at once, and it's almost like there's a choreography going on with all these different screens. I thought that was really clever. I guess you asked about the, you know, like performances and stuff. I guess I do think there's some strong performances here. I don't fault them too much for focusing so much on Regina. I think the actress that plays Regina, Renee Rapp, is quite good. I guess in my limited research, I think she may have originated the role in the Broadway production, so she's a carryover from
I think she was a replacement for the person who originated the role on Broadway. But she's one of the people who made it from the Broadway show into the movie. I think everybody else for the most part is new.
Yeah, I thought she was quite strong, but I think the scene stealer, and I'm going to butcher the name, I'm sure, is the actress that plays Janice.
Ollie Cravalho?
I don't know how to say it. My daughter, I went and saw this with my daughter, who loves musicals. As the end credits were rolling, she goes, "Oh, that's Moana." And I was like, "Huh?" She's like, "That's the actress that does the voice of Moana in the Disney film." Well, I was like, "Oh, okay, I didn't know that." But I thought she was excellent. She has some of the standout vocal performances when it comes to the songs. And she's just a very charismatic figure on screen and is really kind of the driving force, you know, behind a lot of the film moving forward. She's, you know, presented as a narrator type character in this. She's the first thing we see on the screen. And just has a real strength through the whole film. So she was the scene stealer for me.
I think that's a pretty accurate representation. And along with Renee Rapp, both of them have, I think, good charisma, and they stand out in their sequences, which is one of the reasons that I think Angourie Rice suffers a bit in the film. I saw her in The Nice Guys a few years ago, which was one of my favorite films of that year. And she plays the daughter of Ryan Gosling's character. And she was great in that. And she was solid in this, but she does not seem to have the same kind of charisma. I gotta tell you, in 2004, Lindsay Lohan was at the apex of her career. Mm-hmm. And when I watched the movie the other night, I could see why. She had a spark, she had a personality, she had a way of coming across on the screen that was really effective and made the character of Katie much more interesting. And I think that Angourie Rice suffers a little bit in comparison to that. But then on top of that, with those other two performers that we were just talking about, maybe she, you know, doesn't shine quite as bright.
People forget that Lindsay Lohan was actually a very good actress. I mean, the other situations and tabloids and whatever kind of take over your view of different people. But in a bunch of those early films for her, from The Parent Trap to Mean Girls, she's really good. And Mean Girls, it's a little challenging because she's supposed to be a meek,
kind of
slightly
innocent,
out of touch. Innocent character. And in some ways, you know, there's a little bit of a hurdle to get over because even at that point, she was already Lindsay Lohan, you know, and there's a certain degree of glamour or whatever associated with her. So you're kind of going, you know, really? But she sells it in that. I think Angourie Rice, who I had totally forgotten she was in The Nice Guys. I love that movie too. When I was looking up, I was like, oh yeah, she's Betty Brant in the most recent Spider-Man movies, which is a small part, but she's in there. I think she in some ways fits the part better than Lindsay Lohan, but she doesn't really take the opportunities to create a moment for herself. And maybe part of that is the fact that some of these supporting players are just much more interesting. I mean, even some of the other girls that play the plastics, this girl who I've never heard of before, but has one name, Avantika, I hope is how you say that.
Karen.
She was hilarious.
Yes, she was. Great. Yeah, she was very amusing. And, the B.B. Woods as Gretchen was, I thought very, very interactive in the picture. I mean, she's got a story arc that is
Yes.
actually maybe a little bit more engaging and important than the one.
She's
of,
got some of the most heartfelt moments of
yeah.
the film. Yeah.
So it's part of it has to do with the way the characters are being developed in the film, and part of it has to do with the actors. And as we've said, in the transition from the stage to the screen, they cut out a bunch of songs, and that might be something that also contributed to maybe putting Katie on a second tier instead of being on the first tier in the story.
Yeah.
Well, was there anything that you had to say about the film that you would call a criticism? I read a review yesterday from one of my friends online that was very negative and talked about it being kind of all over the place and just a hot mess. And I didn't feel that way about the film. I didn't love the film the way apparently some people do, but I certainly didn't think it was kind of a disaster. Did you see anything that would maybe trip you into that direction and say, well, maybe they stepped in it a little bit here?
Not really. I mean, I really enjoyed my time at the movies yesterday going to see this. And I went out in like -6 degree weather to go see this yesterday morning.
Well, I appreciate you making the effort to do that so you could be on the show today.
But I mean, I've been reading a few other reviews from folks that did not respond to this as well. And I mean, I guess I don't want to stereotype, but the vibe that I get from a lot of them is that sort of not my Mean Girls type of a thing, where these, again, are folks that saw the original back when they were at that formative age. They were teenagers at the time that the original came out, so there was something that connected with them, and it's a very special movie to them. And so then now they're struggling with having this new version. And you know, me going in this with the eyes of someone who saw the original and liked it, but it doesn't have that special place in my heart, I thought this movie was perfectly enjoyable. You know, I mean, you can certainly nitpick here and, you know, here and there with some of the things on this. But, you know, having not seen the Broadway musical, not being familiar with the songs, I mean, I was tapping my toes. I was getting into it. So I enjoyed it quite a bit, and I it doesn't really matter to me if they didn't do, you know, a bunch of stuff that makes it different. You know, if they're going to, repeat lines from the original or things like that, I'm fine with that. I mean, I thought it was wonderfully charming to see Tina Fey in the same role again and Tim Meadows and that. I love those folks. So, you know.
Yeah. And, be careful about a spoiler alert here, but there is a nice little cameo that I appreciated very much. I thought, oh, excellent. That works out really well, and we get just enough of that.
Exactly. I mean, it's – and I get that, you know, it will be divisive for some people. It's anytime you're taking something that is very, very special to people in a certain way, especially from their youth – there will be some struggles for some audiences, but for me, I had a great time with this.
By the way, I noticed when I was looking at the data on Wikipedia that one of the reviews that they quoted was from Kristen.
Oh, yeah.
From the rap. So she was pretty middle of the road about the movie, as I think I am as well. I was perfectly entertained while I was watching it. I enjoyed it. I'm not sorry that I saw it, but it's not the kind of film that I'm going to be going back to time and time again, like so many films that I do see. I said, I can't wait to watch this again. I'm not going to turn it off when it comes on, but I'm not going to be seeking it out, and it won't be one of those things that I just put in automatically when I'm in the mood to watch something down the road. So I would give it a recommendation, and of course, it's not made for me.
Yeah. No, I would recommend it as well. I'm certainly curious to see where this is going to go. Because as we said earlier, this is the third big musical that we've had over the course of a month. And it's the the third also that didn't promote itself as a musical. And it seems like this is doing pretty well for the second weekend in January. I mean, I know both Wonka and The Color Purple have done pretty well at the box office. And so I'm curious if we're going to, as we start moving, into 2025, if we're going to see another wave of musicals, because it seems like these three are doing pretty decent at the box office.
I think they're doing well enough. I don't know that since they're not the overwhelming successes that some films have been, it's not like you look up and you see, well, here's a superhero movie that made $500 million. Let's make one of those. You're mm-hmm. instead looking at something that has been successful, but it's marginally successful, and you say, well, I'm going to really need the right material. I don't think we're going to get Back to the Future, the musical version of the movie.
Mm. Yeah, and see, that's one of those examples of, where would I be at if that movie were made? Because there's a film that is a cultural touchstone for me, and, I have no problems with them doing this stage musical. I've heard it's quite entertaining. But how would I respond if they did a movie like that? Maybe someday we'll find out. I don't know.
It could happen. Like I said, at the moment, I think it's a marginal bet, and Hollywood is not noted for taking a lot of big risks. So I would guess that we'll get a couple of smaller versions of films before anybody takes a chance on something, big.
I'm curious also, Richard, what was the demographic of your screening? Because I know I was the only 52-year-old male in my audience, and I think there may have only been one or two other males, to be honest with you. I went to a fairly early showing on Saturday morning. I think it was like 10:30 in the morning, but it was pretty much all moms and their teenage daughters.
Well, I went to a Thursday preview, and there were several people that it was clear it was date night for them. So there were guys mm-hmm. there in the theater. I wouldn't say the audience was evenly divided, but I would say that it was not overly represented by women. But like I said, that was a Thursday evening preview show.
Right.
And I'm not sure how it's doing the rest of the week. It's like I said, as we talked about, it's not really made for us.
It's not made for us, but I had fun.
Yes, yes. Now, on the other hand, a film that is made for us is The Beekeeper with Jason Statham, a film that I was surprised, I think, last week when we were talking about movies that we would be looking forward to in the next year. Howard Kasner mentioned as something that he was looking forward to because it didn't really seem like it would be up his alley. But,
yeah, no, I heard that too, and I was like, okay, I'm surprised.
But as soon as the first time I saw the trailer, I said, yes, this is a revenge film with Jason Statham. I'm sorry, this is made for me. I am mm-hmm. going to be there opening day, and sure enough, I was. Those of you who aren't aware, The Beekeeper is an action thriller. It comes from David Ayer, who is known for a variety of action kinds of films. He made the original Suicide Squad in 2016, not the James Gunn version of Suicide Squad. And I know that that was a controversial film, and supposedly there's a David Ayer version of Suicide Squad out there. I don't think we're going to be getting that anytime soon. But I didn't have the negative reaction that a lot of people had. That movie was very successful at the box office, even if it was not critically successful, and a lot of people did see it. And he's done several other films as well that I think would probably let me see, I'm trying to remember some of the things he did. Well, he was a writer. He wrote Training Day and U-571. End of Watch, he was the director for that. Fury, he was the director for that. I did not see Bright, but he was responsible
yeah,
for that.
Oh, yeah, the Netflix
that was
buddy
the
cop movie with Will Smith and an orc.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, I don't know anything about that. But the Beekeeper, like I said, it looked like it was genetically designed for me. I'm a fan of Jason Statham. I like revenge films, and this is exactly that. It's very simple setup. Basically, as usual, Statham plays a character who is a former operative for a secret agency. It's like Liam Neeson in 2009, just happens to be operating, you know, as his daughter's protector and rescuer. It doesn't hurt that he has a certain set of skills that he acquired over the years. Well, Jason Statham is a character who obviously has these kinds of skills. I like the introduction of Jeremy Irons' character as the former director of the CIA, who knows even less about this intelligence agency than other people do, and it's because and he's terrified by them because they are really, you know, outside of the official channels. They've got their own star chamber, I guess, that they're operating in, which is kind of interesting. And you know, he's been befriended by an older woman who gets taken in a phishing scam, and you know, tragedy ensues, and he follows up. And I thought his motivation for following up was maybe a little weak, but the follow-up, when he does go after them, was extremely satisfying to me.
I'll say I don't think that his motivation for going after the phishing scammers is weak, because I'm speaking as somebody who – now, I know you're retired, Richard, so you don't maybe deal with this as much as I do, but like – every week, I get multiple emails, not from phishing scam people at work, but I get things from this service that my company has employed to send us things to educate us so that we are getting stuff about how to look for phishing scams and, you know, what not to do and all that stuff. I mean, it's multiple stuff every week. It starts to feel a little bit ridiculous. So I kind of saw, like, I was like in Jason Statham's shoes here, like, I'm going to get revenge for all of those nasty emails that I have to deal with every week that tell me, watch out for this and don't click on that and all that. So I was like, yeah, you get those guys, Statham.
Yeah. Well, what I meant was mostly his relationship with Felicia Rashad seemed a little, you know, underdeloped. We know that there is a little bit of a connection between them, and we see kind of a moment of tenderness at the beginning of the film, but that's it. And basically, he follows through because of what happened to her. Mm-hmm. And it would be interesting if he had other people that he had heard about or had been involved with, or that we knew that they had a deeper relationship. I mean, let's face it, in the course of the story, he encounters this woman's daughter who had no idea who he was and why he was there and what relationship he had with her. So it's like a stranger is suddenly taken, you know, feels a stake for what's happened to this person. That was the thing that I thought was maybe a little weak. But
and the daughter happens to work for the FBI,
yeah,
you know, and is a part of the whole, you know, trying to look for these types of criminals and that, you know, they definitely kind of, how am I trying to say it? They compact a bunch of things together to streamline the process, which on a certain level, I don't mind, because the film wastes no time getting going with Statham getting revenge. So I was okay with that, but you're right. It is underdeveloped.
Yeah. And what is nicely developed, though, are the revenge sequences. I mean, first of all, of course, you know, Jason Statham is the badass who is the ultimate of these fighting folks. The security guards have no expectation that they're going to be successful against them, but it turns out neither is the FBI or SEAL Team 6 or the CIA or anybody else who is responsible for those kinds of, you know, usually those would be the people that we would say, well, those are the badasses in the story, you know, the former SEAL Team members. No, they're sissies in comparison to this group and this particular guy, and he's just one guy. And like I said, when he walks into that call center with those two cans of gasoline, and he just casually tells everybody, I'm going to burn this down. Get out.
And
people look at him going, what are you talking about? This is not how people work. This is not how. And it's like he is completely outside of their sphere of experience.
It's a completely natural reaction from those folks, because it made me think of like when I'm at work and the fire alarm goes off because, you know, I don't know, there's a glitch or, you know, they're testing something. It's never an actual fire. So everybody just sits there and looks at each other and goes,
huh?
Do we need to get out or what? Is that real? You know, and you know, what we're supposed to do is get up and go peacefully to the door and stuff, but nobody does that. We just kind of like, what's going on? Is this okay? No, I'm going to keep working, you know. And
right.
But I also love that these call centers, they're this, I mean, it's the type of thing do they really look like this in real life? You know, it's like I used to always watch CSI, and I used to always go, that's not the way a real police crime scene investigation unit's going to look. I mean, really, you're going to tell me that, you know, whatever city's crime scene investigation, they've got these clear screen right on boards, you know, and I'm always thinking, you can't see anything when you write on those. How are those effective and all that? You know, it's all glitz and no actual substance. You know, it doesn't look like it would actually be practical. It's the same thing here where you've got like, you know, flashing neon lights and big screens and this guy that's jumping around the room like he thinks he's Leonardo DiCaprio's character from Wolf of Wall Street. You know, it's completely ridiculous. But still, when you see Jason Statham take care of that, it does give you that little bit of satisfaction, you know?
it does, you know. And the idea, it's interesting that the three characters that are the scumbag villains, you know, you've got the director at the one operating center that he takes care of early on, and then there's the other guy who is challenging the security teams right to close down his operation.
Right.
And then of course there's the main villain, and they're all so self-righteously full of themselves that you want to kick their ass yourself.
You know? I loved Josh Hutcherson in this. He's kind of the main you know, scumbag that's at the top of this thing, this spoiled bratty kid who's got, you know, rich and powerful family and all that, which, you know, we won't spoil here too. I will say the film takes a big swing in the third act.
You know, it does.
Which I kind of was a little bit charmed by, but I was still like, whoa, we took a jump there. But I thought Josh Hutcherson, I mean, coming off where he was just a complete piece of wood in Five Nights with Freddy's earlier this season, he was just wonderfully scuzzy in this. I don't know. I thought it was great.
I was laughing at all of the stuff that they had in his in the corporate headquarters where he's operating. You know, he's got a masseuse and he's got a Dharma.
Right, the guy with
going on.
The bowls, whatever they do
like,
with that.
Oh my gosh, you know, it was so silly, and it reminds, there's so many of these startups that they all want to emulate, you know, the Google kind of manifest. It's a campus. It's not really a job. It's we're a community, and we've got all these extra touches that make it a little bit different. And I'm going, and they're taking this guy to the extreme level.
Yeah, there's a sushi bar there, and he's riding around the halls on a skateboard and all that stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah,
I wanted to punch him just for that.
I was like, does anybody actually work in this place? Give me a break. See, we're bringing out our old man vibe here.
That's it.
Richard, that's awesome. Which I got to say, too, when I went to this screening, and you know, we were talking about the demographics of our screenings for Mean Girls, with this one, I went on Friday afternoon, and I was definitely the youngest person in the audience. Everybody else in my screening were senior citizens, and a bunch of them were, you know, out together. I got the impression a bunch of these folks knew each other, But I was like, oh, the marketing really worked on this, where it was the idea where you have this elderly character played by Felicia Rashad, and she gets taken advantage of, and then there's revenge for that. Something about that struck a chord with this old folks group, and they came out to see revenge for taking advantage of an old lady. I thought that was great, and it was funny, too, because like there was this elderly couple sitting in front of me, and just listening to them react during the sequence where Felicia Rashad is on her laptop and the scammers are telling her, oh yeah, click this and download this. And they're sitting there going, ooh, no,
no.
I was like, these folks have been getting messages from their group or whatever saying, yeah, don't click on that. And you know, they're, I guess the anti-phishing things to help out the elderly is working there, because they knew that that was a problem.
Yeah, it's. I think as we've gone on, people become more and more familiar with all of those schemes. It's maybe a little bit less intrusive. I don't say intrusive, but less likely to be successful. It's like when they first started out, and it was, you know, the prince from Nigeria asking people to help him get his money out of the bank, you know, that kind of thing. People, they got past that within a couple of years, and everybody knew that that sort of thing happened. And then the pop-ups, like we get in this kind of film, I think people are a little bit more cognizant of. But let's face it, Felicia Rashad's character says at one point, my daughter set this all up for me. I don't know what's going on. And I know that there are people that are like that. Hey, there's plenty of times when I'm looking at something. I'm not sophisticated at all when it comes to technology, but I am very anxious anytime somebody wants access to any information at all. Mm-hmm. And I'm going, no, I don't think so.
Hey, like I said before, I'm 52. I grew up with computers, but I still have to call my son over to do some things for me because I'm just not up to date on the latest stuff. So yeah, I'm on that wavelength too. I was going to ask you what you think of Statham in this one in general, because I mean Statham, I mean, let's face it, he pretty much plays the same character in every movie he's in.
Yeah, well, I think in other movies he's had more personality, more comic beats, mm-hmm. opportunities to kind of do a little acting. This is not an acting role here. The way I thought of it is a little bit like, this is the Terminator, only it's the good side of the Terminator.
Exactly.
We've got an implacable foe who is not going to be stopped regardless of what you do, but instead of coming after the good guys, he's going after the bad guys. And I like that. And if I was going to count the number of lines he had in the film, I don't think it's the lowest of any star in a film. I think over the years there have been plenty of Clint Eastwood movies where, you know, Clint maybe had 50 lines or something like that. Mm-hmm. But this was pretty low. He's not doing a lot of talking in the movie except with his hands and feet. And I like all of those combat sequences, all of the fights that he has, and I would say probably 70-75% of the action is the physical martial arts kind of stuff, and maybe only a quarter of the action involves weapons of some sort. But he's also, you know, does his talking with the guns, and mm-hmm. I'm fine with that too. Like you said, his character is consistent throughout these kinds of movies. There's some of these movies where he's trying to play somebody a little bit more sophisticated, somebody who's a little got a little personality. I like him in all those Guy Ritchie films, for instance, that he's been in, and the Fast and the Furious movies. They've kind of given him a little bit of a comic edge to him, but none of that is present here. It's just all, you know, business work, and his business is kicking people's asses.
Yeah, I mean, he's you're right, he has very little dialogue in this. It's a very solitary performance. I mean, he doesn't even really have like a confidant, somebody that, you know, comes onto his side in all this. He's basically doing this all on his own. I mean, even the relationship with with the daughter, who's the FBI agent, that she's not really on his side, you know.
No, she's after him, just like he's after them.
So, yeah, no, I liked what Statham was doing this. I don't need him to be doing the one-liners or anything like that. I thought he was a lot of fun, and I loved. I guess one of the things about it is there's almost more in just the reactions of everybody else to what he's doing.
Yes, like, no, that's...
You know, watching Jeremy Irons process all this and deal with it is wonderful. I loved some of the very cartoonish opponents that are he's put up against. I mean,
the, at the end especially.
At the end especially, but there's also like that the current beekeeper who's
right.
The kind of punk girl that shows up at the gas station in that one scene. And I was like, where is this character coming from? This is nuts. But then, this team of mercenaries in the third act, I was like, they look like a bunch of G.I. Joe action figures from when I was a kid. You know, they're just bizarre looking.
Yeah, they don't blend in very well with the Secret Service and the other the FBI agents there. It seemed very over the top, you know, the cartoon villains that you're getting, which was okay. I like that. Like you said, the current beekeeper shows up, and I'm going, wait a second. They're supposed to be operating kind of independently. They're supposed to be, you know, fixing things on the outside of the system, and that beekeeper is insane.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like, how is this working? How did they get that person in? You know. It's a character that's almost a 180 from Statham's character, but they had the same job. That doesn't make a lot of sense, but it doesn't have to make a lot of sense. It's because it's just 3 minutes of confrontation where we're going to get, you know, a minigun being used in a gas station.
So speaking of not making sense, I wonder if you want to throw up a spoiler alert, because I'm kind of itching to talk about where things go in the third act.
Okay, folks, you know, if you don't want to know too much about the beekeeper, let's face it, you already know 95% of what's going on in the beekeeper, and you're not going to be surprised by the outcomes on any of these things. But there is a path that does take place in the last third of the film that maybe would be a spoiler for people. So we're going to... Todd and I are going to talk about it right now, and if you don't want to know, you should tune out for a few minutes. Go ahead, Todd.
So, I guess as the film is progressing, I'm going, all right, I have the feeling that, you know, there's more to Josh Hutcherson's character than we're being told here. He's got some kind of connection to somebody that's powerful on a certain level, and, you know, gradually this is building, and then there's the moment where they're about to reveal, and we start to see the mother, and I'm going, okay, so she's in government. I was going, all right, she's a senator or a congresswoman. Okay, I'm fine with that. I would have been just like, okay, yeah, no you're fine. But she's the president
of the United States. Yes.
And I was like, okay, that's really taking a leap here. I mean, suddenly, I guess Josh Hutcherson is Hunter Biden. I mean, seriously.
Yeah, no, yeah, it is a Hunter Biden moment kind of thing.
Because I mean, legit. I mean, and you know, all of you know, listening to this show enough. If you listen to my show, I don't do politics on my shows because I think, you know, I don't want to divide people. I hate that subject.
That's not what we're here for.
That's not what we're here for. But, I mean, literally, they're putting things here. You know, he's doing drugs. He's involved in shifty, you know, company deals. You know, got his fingers in all kinds of different pots and all that stuff. And I'm going, literally, they did the villain is Hunter Biden. And I kind of had a little bit of fun with that. I was like, this is completely ridiculous that they make his mother the president, but I was already on board with a lot of craziness up to that point. So I just rolled with it.
Well, it suddenly doesn't seem nearly as preposterous given the context of the world now that that's the reveal that we get. I did like the fact that the president in this story is portrayed as somebody who does feel a sense of obligation to a different moral code than her son has. She's not in particular a co-conspirator, even though it may have benefited her to some degree. It's not something that she felt like this was the right thing to do. Her defense of him is just purely as a child, not as somebody who is that she's indebted to for any power that she has. And the same thing with Jeremy Irons. He's not the Snidely Whiplash behind the whole plot. He's maybe is a little bit of a sellout, but he's not. I mean, he literally tells the guy, "You have screwed up big time."
Yeah.
And I can't do anything for you. You're out of luck, buddy.
I mean, that's one of the things that's great about Jeremy Irons' character is that he really can't believe the whole movie that he is in this situation, that he's got to clean up after this little punk. He dutifully does his best, but I mean, the whole time Jeremy Irons is like, you're not going to make it out of this.
Do you think that Minnie Driver worked more than a day?
Oh my gosh. I was surprised when she showed up. I was like, is that Minnie Driver? And then she's barely in the movie.
Yeah. She's in it. She's like the FBI director.
Yeah. Well, I thought the same thing actually about John Hamm in Mean Girls. I was like, John Hamm is in two scenes and they're both in the trailer.
Yeah. I think he worked a day too.
Yeah.
So we have those things in common between the two films, kind of star appearances in small parts that probably were filmed in a day.
Mm-hmm.
I take it you enjoyed the film.
I did. I had fun. I mean, when I walked out of the theater Friday afternoon, I said, that's the kind of movie that you schedule for the second week of January. I mean, Liam Neeson used to have a movie around this time every year too.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's the kind of movie I want to see at this time of year. It's cold out. I'm making an effort to go to the movies and all that. And this is just a good just sit down and watch a bunch of things get shot and blow up and It's just mindless fun.
It does exactly what it's supposed to do. It's not got any pretensions of being, a message picture. Nobody is going to be getting the Academy Award for anything in this, unless they do a stunt Academy Award finally, in which case this film would probably be eligible for a lot of things.
Oh yeah, no, like you were saying, the fight sequences are great. That one on the stairway in the last act is amazing.
Mm-hmm. No, it was very satisfying. It's like when you anticipate going to your favorite restaurant and ordering the thing that you love the most, and you get there and it comes out and you take that first bite and you go, yes, this is why I'm here. This is why I made the effort to come to this restaurant. I want this particular meal. And that's what this was, for me. It was like, this is the slice of pie that I wanted, and it's exactly the temperature I wanted it at, and it tastes perfect.
Yeah. It was a lot of fun.
All right. Well, we got in two movies here. We're going to take a very quick break, and when we come back, Todd and I have an exit question for you to listen to. So hang on a second, and we're going to hear from a fellow Lamb Podcasting Network show.
Hi, I'm Jason Soto.
And I'm Lisa Leahy.
And we're the host of Between the Scares, a podcast that takes a look at every movie that Blumhouse Productions has made. You may not recognize the name, but they have made some of your favorite horror movies like Paranormal Activity, Ouija, and Insidious.
Yeah, Jason, but they've also made stupid movies like The Fever and Best Night Ever and Hysterical Blindness.
Yeah, those two. But they also did Whiplash, Get Out, and Us, and we're going to cover it all.
Hey, did you know that Jason Blum also produced that Gem and the Holograms live-action movie?
He did that?
Uh-huh.
Ugh, fine. But then you have to watch The Green Inferno. So listen to Between the Scares on Anchor, Apple, Google, Amazon, or our home location at rabbitholepodcasts.com.
We're back. It's time for our exit question of the week. And because the main film on our show today was a musical that was hidden as a musical, which I'm surprised at, Todd and I mentioned earlier that both Wonka, The Color Purple, as well as this film, it would be hard for you to know that they were musicals before you see the films, because they haven't really promoted them that way. But we had a discussion about musicals earlier. So our question for the exit here is real simple. What modern musicals would you recommend? And I told Todd anything from 2000 up to today would be something that would be worth talking about. So, Todd, have you got a few that you would recommend?
Well, I mainly focused in on one. The first thing that came to my mind, I didn't really dig deeper because I was like, this one, I think this one is great. So I went to 2007 and Hairspray, which I think is appropriate given that it's another one that was originally a movie and then turned into a Broadway show and then turned into a movie again.
Yeah.
And I mean, the original John Waters Hairspray, I think, is a really fun movie too. But the 2007 musical version is just wonderful. This is one that we've talked a lot before about movies that suck you in, and if you like turn it on and it's on TV and you're coming in partway, you know, it just kind of grabs you. And this is one I think that has grabbed me several times, and I've been traveling and gone into a hotel room and flipped on the TV and it's like, oh my goodness, there's Hairspray. Well, guess what I'm doing for the next hour and a half, you know. It's just a lot of fun. And I think the songs in this one, this is one where the songs really have stuck with me. I mean, we were talking about whether or not certain songs are showstoppers or whatnot. I mean, the You Can't Stop the Beat number, which is kind of the climax of this whole thing, is just a song that once I start thinking about it, just echoes in my head over and over and over again. A great cast in this one. I mean, I think I know it was a search for an unknown to find the girl that was going to fill Ricky Lake's shoes and play Tracy in this. And Nikki Blonsky, I think, is just delightful in this. I thought John Travolta is a wonderful as her mother. It's hard to imagine, taking over a role from other iconic performances. I mean, you think about Divine playing the role in the original film, and I know Harvey Fierstein was especially known for it on Broadway. John Travolta makes it his own, does a great job. And then even just all the rest, I mean, you know, from Michelle Pfeiffer, Amanda Bynes, Christopher Walken, Queen Latifah, wonderful performances from all these folks. Even Jerry Stiller. Jerry Stiller, he's my favorite part of this film. I think he's the one carryover, because he appeared in the original film too in a different role. But yeah, this one just gets my blood pumping every time I hear it. This was a soundtrack that we used to play over and over again in the car when we would go on family vacation. You know, you're taking those long drives and you're driving across Nebraska and Iowa and stuff. We'd always put on the Hairspray soundtrack. So yeah, that's definitely the first one that comes to mind for me when it comes to post-2000 movie musicals.
Well, that's one of the ones that popped into my head. I thought for sure that it would get mentioned, and it is. It's terrific. It's been a while since I've seen it, you know, now that I think about it. When it first came out, we saw it quite regularly, and like you, I think we had the soundtrack that we played in the car frequently driving around, you know, back around town doing whatever we were doing, and I enjoyed it quite well. I now want to go back and revisit it because, like I said, I think it's been 10 years since I've seen it, and that just seems too long. Well, we talked about one of these musicals just a month ago on the show, Anna and the Apocalypse, which is it's like High School Musical with zombies. And
I still haven't seen it. I know I need to see it.
You know, and it has the knockout showstopper song in it that I thought was missing from Mean Girls, and that's Hollywood Ending. And so when if anybody catches up with our podcast about the show, that I think is the standout moment in the film when it comes to the musical numbers anyway. But the film that I would recommend to people the most that is a kind of contemporary musical is Sing Street, which is just absolutely wonderful. It's set in the 1980s. It's set in Ireland. We're getting kids who are putting together a band. They're struggling to connect. They're in an oppressive school environment. That's a big surprise. Isn't it always an oppressive school environment? But apparently it appears that that was not too far from reality. And what's really interesting is they got cooperation from the school in putting the film together. And apparently there have been big changes over the years. So that part is nice. But the songs are great. The enthusiasm of the kids is wonderful. There's a nice love story at the heart of the movie. And I would take that soundtrack and listen to it anytime because the songs are so good in that movie. And it's from the same guy who did Once and what was the other film that he did? The with Mark Ruffalo and...
Begin Again?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. What's his name? John Carney. And, you know, apparently, you know, he's got some kind of hook in my brain. You know, there's something about the way he tells the stories and the songs that he produces that are, you know, very affecting. And I just like the fact that this is almost a movie that's like Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland, let's put on a show, only it's much more contemporary than that. Mm. And it features music in the style of the 80s, and they ape the music videos, too, of the time period. And like I said, have you seen Sing Street?
I haven't. I mean, it's been recommended to me many, many times, but when you mentioned that, I was like, oh, you know, how many times have people told me I need to watch this movie and I still haven't watched it yet?
Well, do yourself a favor. Since you're trapped in nearly sub-zero weather, you know, you should you should look around and see if you can find it, because it is definitely worth your time and energy. And if you know what, if you have to rent it, I'll give you the money back guarantee. If you don't love the movie, I'll pay for it for you.
I wouldn't make you do that for me, Richard.
All right, my friends. That's been our show today. Todd and I are all alone in our discussion of Mean Girls and The Beekeeper, but that's okay. Next time we're going to have a lot more lambs on the show. Those of you who are listening or watching the podcast on the YouTube channel, make sure that you... you know, keep track of what's going on the site, because we're going to have some updates here in the near future. I want to ask Todd if he has something new to promote. I know he was on a little bit of a hiatus with his podcast, but have you got new shows up now, Todd?
The first one after the hiatus should be hitting in the next day or so. I'm supposed to edit later today. So we're kicking off the new year this week with Lee Grice from the Never Seen podcast is joining me to discuss a film called Warlords of Atlantis, which was released in 1978. And then I am the next episode after that. I'm joined by Alexander Robinson, and we are talking about a film from the late 80s starring Kevin Bacon and Sean Astin, which is called Whitewater Summer.
All right. Sounds like a lot of fun. I don't think I've seen either of those films, so it'll be something that I'll want to spend some time with, catching up with those things. Thank you, Todd, for showing up today. I hope that you didn't get frostbite going to the movies yesterday.
No.
And we'll catch you all next time here on the Lambcast. Have a good one, everybody. Bye.
You've been listening to the Lambcast.
If you have an idea for a show or would like to join us on the Lambcast, contact us at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Find us on Facebook, just search for Lambcast, or on Twitter, at Lambcast. The Lamb site can be found at largeassmovieblogs.com, and please head over to iTunes to leave us a review.
Go to hell. Go to hell. Go to hell. Go to hell. Oh no. Go to hell. Go to hell. Go to hell. Go to hell. Oh no. Sheep go to heaven. Goats go to hell.
Be careful, it could go off for, like, no reason.